Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, history friends, patrons all. Welcome to October's collaboration episode. It's two parts, a two-part collaboration episode, because I just couldn't get Sebastian Major to stop talking. No, I'm just kidding. Sebastian Major joins us. Sebastian Major, if you didn't know, is from Our Fake History, which is a really, really good podcast, and I really have to recommend it because, for me, it was very useful and very interesting, giving me some little background, little interesting nuggets on the last siege of Vienna. So make sure you check out Our Fake History by searching for it in your favorite podcatcher or going to ourfakehistory.com. So what's going on? What's in the box here? Why should you care about this collaboration episode, and what exactly is here to interest you if you're just stopping by? Well, let me just put it this way. Sebastian Major is a very interesting guy. He's a very talented guy. He's a teacher. He's Canadian. He's a Canadian citizen. And he's very much not at all a fan of white supremacy. He wanted you to know that because, oh dear, he wanted you to know that because for whatever reason that comes up about like five different times in this episode. But it's a very fun conversation. As you can see, it's been split into two halves. The first half is coming out to everyone in the one go. The second half will be out next week for normal listeners, but it's out straight away for patrons. So if you're in the mood for feasting on everything all at once, make sure to go to patreon.com/whendiplomacyfails and follow on from there. Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be a very, very fun collab. I really had fun doing this. I had a really good time talking to Sebastian Major because sometimes you just come across people who you feel like you can really get on well with. I've never had a collaboration episode where I've been like, oh, I hate this guy, I can't stand him. But I think there's been certain ones where I'm like, wow, this went so well. It was so easy. Like, yes, I had to prepare some stuff, some questions, but you can tell when the conversation flows naturally and when the kind of the personal part, as opposed to the more kind of informative part of the collaboration episode, when the casual personal me just talking to him about his life and about his career and his interest in history, etc., when that lasts longer than the actual segment of Vienna, that's how you know that you're on to a winner. And if you want to hear two history podcasters just shoot the breeze about what's going on with history podcasting and why they love it so much and what they do enjoy, what they don't enjoy, the specific examples of things that they want to do in the future and what they have done already, then oh, stay tuned. It's one of those really hard kind of ones to define, so I'm not going to try and remember all the little bits. There's some nice surprises in here, and yeah, it's just a fun conversation. I've been told that it's really good to listen to these while you're running. So if you're running right now, I really, really hope you enjoy this. If you're not running right now, I hope you enjoy it anyway. And yeah, let's just get into it. I'll see you very shortly. And remember, there's a second part to this, so listen to that if you happen to be interested. The next voices you hear will be mine and Sebastian Major's. Let's do this. Zach Twomley, When Diplomacy Fails, and Sebastian Major, Our Fake History. Thanks. And enjoy. My friend told me the other day that the same guy who I was talking to at that barbecue, he said, oh, are you listening to history podcasts? And he didn't even really know that I was a history podcaster. He sort of did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but he just kind of, we were talking about history, and then when he brought it up, I was actually like, I'm a history podcaster. But then he was literally like, look me dead in the eye. He looked me dead in the eye, Sebastian. And he was like,
have you ever listened to our fake history?
And I was like, no way, I'm going to do a collaboration with him. And he was like, oh, that's so cool. And then I was kind of trying to be like, you know, I have my own podcast. And then he was like, so, and then he just changed the subjects completely.
Yeah, well, you know what, like, if you really want to blow that guy's mind, and this is true, and we can say this on the recording too, but when I was thinking about starting my podcast, When Diplomacy Fails is one of the ones I was listening to.
Really?
And it was. No, I was. I listened to your series on the 7 Years' War, and also just some of your very early episodes. Yeah, it just helped me sort of kind of get confident that I could do it too. Not, I don't know if that sounds somehow degrading of what you were putting out there, but it was just like this guy seems like a regular dude.
Yeah.
You at the time, I think you were still in university, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, this is a regular guy who's doing this just because he's passionate about it, and he's putting out something that's pretty good. So it made me kind of feel like, yeah, you know what? I think I could throw my hat in the ring. But
yeah.
So you were a bit of an inspiration to me. So tell that back to your buddy and be like, yeah, man, I inspired that dude. So deal with
cool.
that.
Yeah, yeah, I'm gonna go with that next time I see him. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, well. Welcome, Sebastian Major from Our Fake History, and thanks very much for joining us on When Diplomacy Fails.
Huge pleasure to be here. Thanks so much, Zach.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Well, we have a good bit of stuff to talk about today, but as is my wont, I like to get to know the history podcaster that I'm on with before I start to kind of lob the more weighted questions at them. So, with that being said, tell us a bit about yourself. Where are you from, in case people don't know, and what is your podcast baby, Our Fake History, and what's its kind of niche? What does it cover?
Okay. Well, I live in Toronto, Canada, and I grew up just north of the city of Toronto. I am a Canadian. I'm one of a handful of Canadian podcasters out there. Our Fake History is a show about historical myths. So it's a show about stories that people think are history, but maybe were just made up somewhere along the line. And then also history that might be hidden in legends. Examples of that might be a story that people think is history is that Napoleon shot off the nose of the Sphinx, right? That's a common sort of understood idea that, like, Napoleon got to Egypt and was like, you know what? I don't like the look of the Sphinx. I'm going to set up my cannon and blow its nose off.
Yeah.
No, that's a completely manufactured story. And in fact, the real story of how the Sphinx lost its nose is very interesting in its own right. The other sort of side of what I do is I look at a legend. So something like, the story of the Trojan War, or the story of Atlantis, or eventually next year I'm going to be looking at the story of Robin Hood. And these are stories that people just assume are entirely fiction that might just have a kernel of historical truth at the heart of them. So
cool.
I kind of explore that as well.
Ah, very good. I suppose I should have realized, but when I hear Our Fake History, I'm like, hey, do you ever watch the show Mythbusters?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I think of. I'm like, you're the historical Mythbuster kind of guy, except with less explosions. But yeah, it's cool that you can take it the other way around and see if there's actually some truth behind the likes of Troy and that kind of thing. Yeah, that's cool.
Just to add to that, one thing that that was important to me is that a lot of myth-busting shows have this very, like, snarky attitude, like, oh, you were so stupid to ever believe that fake thing. Like, how could you be so dumb? And that's not really the spirit of the show I'm trying to put out there because the stories are really good. And so Our Fake History is more of a celebration of those stories.
Sure.
And when they're not true, kind of showing the process of how we figure that out using sort of historical research methods. And when they are true, sort of relishing how amazing these weird stories actually are.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to just be the like, well, actually, you're dumb for ever thinking that Napoleon could have shut the nose of the Sphinx, you dumb. Like, that's not me.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Okay. So you take a considerate approach to history. That's good.
I try to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to be, because you have to be careful in this day and age. I mean, I covered the 1916 Rising for the centenary of it. And right. If you didn't know, in Ireland, it's a very big deal. And to this day, our political process is still shaped by it. And to a lesser extent, our political parties are. But there's like this idea that, oh, noble Irish rebels resisted and everything. And to a lot of people, that is enough for them. But to other people, they want to know kind of what really happened. And you have to be careful, as I well knew when I decided to give my own take on it. But yeah. I absolutely didn't want to be like, oh, you're wrong, and this is why. I wanted to be like, this is why I feel this way. And I suppose yours is more fact-based, but that was the kind of the first time when I really delved into something and was kind of like really passionate about it. Do you ever get really kind of passionate about your topics? I suppose, is there any maybe Canadian myths or anything like that, or anything closer to home?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. I haven't really gone deep into a Canadian topic yet. And that's not because I don't think Canadian history is interesting. It's funny. Canadian history has a reputation as being one of the most boring national histories out there. But I don't think that's true. And actually, as a history teacher, I think that's a kind of an unfair stereotype. I think we've got just as much drama in our past as any other nation. But for whatever reason, I haven't really delved deep into a Canadian topic. But one thing I do want to do, I eventually want to do a whole series on a couple big sort of Canadian mythological figures. So in Canadian history, colonially, and this is to say nothing about Indigenous Canadians, the First Nations people,
sure.
But the colonial sort of presence in Canada was first the French and then the English. And so there's these two weird archetypes that exist between the French and the English, and they are the voyageur, which is the sort of French fur trader who's like out in the canoe exploring the Canadian wilderness. And then there's the lumberman. And the lumberman, many of the early lumberjacks were actually French and Indigenous for that matter, but there's this idea in the Canadian consciousness that the lumbermen were somehow English and the voyageurs were French. And there's this rich mythology. There's all these crazy lumberjack stories in Canada. And then there's also all these amazing voyageur stories as well. I want to kind of do a lumberman voyageur series. And I think by sort of unpacking those two characters and getting into all the weird legends around those two characters, you can also maybe understand a little something about the dynamics between French and English Canada.
Oh, yeah.
So that's an idea that I have.
And in the kind of same vein as what I was talking about with Ireland, would that kind of, would say the French Canadians, would they identify themselves more as the voyageurs, or and the English kind of speaking population would identify themselves more as lumberjacks, or is that taking it way too far?
Well, it might be. I mean, it depends which French Canadian you're sort of speaking to. But I think the stereotypes out there are that, you know, that English Canadians sometimes like to sort of see themselves as these sort of tough guys and like to unfairly stereotype the French as being somehow more effete, right? Which is completely untrue. And the French actually see it the other way around. They're like, no, we were the original colonial presence here. We were the ones that, like, you know, went out in the canoes with the with the Indigenous people and like kind of made this country. So don't like look down your nose at us. And I mean, that's just a tiny taste of the, you know, giant world of tension between French and English Canada.
Yeah.
We're actually at a nice spot with that right now in our country. I'm sure you might get a French Canadian listener, you know, chiming in being like, Sebastian is overlooking, you know, continued tensions.
Yeah.
But there was a period of time where it looked like Quebec was going to separate from the rest of Canada. There was a independence movement. There still is an independence movement. I shouldn't say it's gone, but it seems to have lost a lot of the political will that was once behind it.
Right.
So I feel as though we're at sort of a, a better moment between French and English relations in Canada at the moment.
Okay, good. Well, that's always good to hear. I mean, nice to have some good news for once.
Yeah, I know, right?
So, I mean, you mentioned there that you're a history teacher, which I've always loved the idea that I'm kind of trying to do it the opposite way. I'm being a podcaster, a history podcaster, and then my aim is to teach history. But you're doing it the opposite way. You put, I don't know if you could put the cart before the horse, or maybe you had the cart and then you got the, I don't know what way to use that analogy here. But in any case, you teach history and then you become a history podcaster. How does that work? Actually, no, maybe to break it down, what is it like? What is it like to teach history where you are, say?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so in Ontario, every high school student has to take at least one history course. And I wish it was more, but you only have to take one. And that is 20th century Canadian history. And that course is basically about World War I, World War II. And if you get through all of that, plus the interwar years, you've kind of done well in that course. Mm. The course, when you really kill that course, you're able to like take it all the way till really pretty much the 1980s in Canada. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the idea. But it's obviously, I mean, you look at something as complex as World War I. I don't need to tell you. You did a massive series on World War I. It's very easy to get bogged down in the wars because they're so complex and also so interesting, right? There's so there's such dramatic moments in the world's past that, you know, it's hard not to get stuck there. But it's also important that the kids know what happened throughout the rest of the 20th century.
Of course.
But actually, 20th century history isn't really my favorite. And I think people that listen to my show might have noticed that like 20th century topics are pretty few and far between on my show. There's been a couple, but I'm more interested in the deeper past. Mm-hmm. So there are a bunch of elective courses that you can also take as a high school student in Ontario. So you can take courses on ancient history. There's a really fun course called The West and the World, which is sort of it's supposed to be the history of the world, but it ends up getting kind of Europe focused despite attempts to break it out of that from the Renaissance basically to World War I. That's my favorite course. That's the stuff that I'm really excited about and interested in.
Okay.
You can also take an American history course. And right now there's this big move to bring in more history of Indigenous people into the curriculum. So there's sort of a new Aboriginal Studies, Indigenous Studies course in the Canadian curriculum.
Okay, cool. Sounds like very well-rounded altogether by the sounds of things.
I mean, if you're someone that's interested in history, then there are options for you, but a lot of times what ends up happening is the kids take that one grade 10 history course and then they drop it. And so it's like they know about World War II and to them, World War II is history. That's
it.
You know?
Yeah, I can understand that, I suppose. I mean, it's very much the same over here, except it's like, I'd say the famine in the 1840s, that's when it kind of starts. And then you've got like the kind of period of revolution, 1916, and then the War of Independence. Maybe the First World War is sprinkled in there if you're lucky, and then the Second World War, and that's kind of the end of it then.
Right. Well, yeah. I guess because Ireland's independence movement sort of overlaps with World War I, I guess in Ireland the independence movement kind of gets more airtime.
Yeah, very much so. But, I mean, I suppose we can talk about this later. Actually, no, wait, let's talk about it now. I mean, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, it sounds obvious now considering your profession, but it was, how important is history to you? And I know that's a fairly open-ended question. You can go all sorts of ways with that, but I always like hearing people's reactions because it's something I try to ask each guest I have on for a collaboration. So how important is history to you, Mr. Major?
I would say pretty important. That is a huge question. It's something that I've always been passionate about. It's it's something that, you know, from a young age, it was something I gravitated to. And I think if you're someone that gets deep into history, and I'm sure you can relate to this,
sure,
you start getting this weird completist thing where you're like, okay, I now feel like I understand the history of my own country. Okay, now I feel like I understand the history of, like, the colonial ancestors of my country. Oh, okay, now I need to understand the history of the entire world. And, you know, there's, you just like, you find yourself like, oh, there's eras that I don't know enough about. I need to go deeper there, or there are geographic regions that I need to know more about. And I know right now I feel like the show has done a disservice to places like the continent of Africa and huge parts of Asia that I haven't really, especially India, that I haven't really talked about at all. I want to. I also, you know, I think it's important that we understand that, you know, the history of the world is more than just the history of Europe and North America, which is so often we kind of just, you know, fall into that old, in that old rut. And my show is actually just as guilty of it as anyone else's. I find myself sort of gravitating back to these European or North American topics. And so I have to actively try and push myself out of that.
Sure.
But sorry, yeah. I'm on a tangent, but...
No, I think that question's kind of designed to bring people on tangents, so it's not really...
Yeah, no. But I do think it's important that people understand the past.
Yeah.
I think being able to understand the past makes you a more critical thinker and makes you better able to understand the present. Mm. And I don't... Sometimes I get kind of annoyed by the idea of, you know, the he who does not understand history is doomed to repeat it, because I don't think it's that simple.
No.
And I don't really think that history repeats itself.
Mm.
But isn't there that old Mark Twain quote that, like, history doesn't always repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes?
Yeah.
And that's, I do agree with that. I don't think history repeats itself. I think that the deeper you get into studying history, the more you just become so aware that every moment has its own unique factors that sort of made it.
Mm.
And to think that those exact same factors could pop up again, I think it misunderstands how human beings work. We're just, there's so much randomness in the human experience. But
yeah.
with that said, I also think that understanding the story, or understanding, you know, how we got to where we are, just helps you see through some of the bullshit of your own times.
Yeah.
you know what I mean?
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's incredibly important. I think we need to understand the past. I think everyone should at least have a working understanding of history, in the same way that I think that everyone should have a working understanding of geography, because without it, you're just lost at sea and things just seem completely random. And with an understanding of history, at least it gives you context.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, yeah, it matters to me.
Yeah, cool. No, that's good. It's interesting, because for our 5-year birthday project that we did, where we released 2 episodes every day for 5 weeks, was a bit mad. But one of the things I did in that at the very beginning of it was I had this episode saying why history is important, and I ran through all the usual ones that, like, people, I ran through the usual reasons people give, like, oh, it teaches critical learning skills, and it roots us in the present and everything, and it helps us know where we came from and how bad things were and all that kind of thing. And I would always argue that, yes, that's true. But I would also look to the criticisms of it as well, like the fact that people often say, oh, history is really boring, or my least favorite one of all time, which is, oh, history is just a load of dates. Like,
no way.
makes me shudder to think that, like, Like, I was able to get, how many hours? 15 hours or something of content or more out of a month in history in the July Crisis Project. I was able to get, like, stupid amount of time out of that. And similarly with other periods of history as well, I've milked them till literally not even the cows come home, but till there's no more cows left to milk. So when people are like, oh, there's just dates, I'm like, seriously, context is so important. And then when you see what the context is, you're better equipped to kind of tell a story. And history really is stories. And to me, it can't be dull, because human beings, by their very nature, are not dull. And human beings, by their very nature, can teach us so much. Like, even if you look at, like, some of the really important figures and their different traits and their different flaws and all that kind of thing, and we can learn so much from them. And even then, it's just as entertaining or just as fascinating to learn about that as it is, I feel, to learn a language. But anyway, I always ask the person the question, and then I go on a tangent myself
I hear you. No, that's the thing. I'm so with you. When people say history is boring, it's like, do you think that, like, human experience is boring?
Yeah.
There's so many amazing things that have happened, and so many weird, and that's the other thing that with my show, I always end up kind of gravitating to these weird things that have also happened, right? These sort of things that sort of defy explanation in some ways. And that to me is endlessly fascinating. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you, you know, deeply there that, you know, another really important reason why people should learn history is that it gives you a deeper understanding of what it is to be a human.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, helps us exist.
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does. And from that, I could ask you this question, and don't worry, it's a lot more straightforward.
No, good. No, I'm enjoying this.
So you are a big fan of history. You are a big, you're in history's corner, so to speak. So what would you say to people that kind of, I don't know if this is happening in Canada so much, but you touched on it briefly, how, like, history is being kind of, you can take it up, it's optional, you can drop an elective, you can take up, like, as a core module, that kind of thing. How would you feel for, like, towards the people that argue that, oh, history should be not, like, it shouldn't be, like, essential, you shouldn't have to do it, compulsory, it shouldn't be compulsory as a subject to do, you should be able to drop it just as you'd, like, drop, I don't know, whatever other optional subjects there are out there. I'm not really sure how it works in Canada, but over here you take... traditionally, until you do your junior cert, which is when you're about 15, 16 in age, until you're at that stage, you take literally every subject and you get a light enough introductory course to them. But over here in Ireland, there's a kind of movement to kind of remove the likes of history, the kind of arts subjects that get a bad rep because they're not seen as, there's no utilitarian value to them. Like, let's just teach people science and maths and all that kind of thing. And that's that. And I'm kind of thinking, like, it's just so kind of, I don't know, North Korean, for lack of a better term. You just teach people, like, all these really scientific things. And yes, they're important. I mean, obviously science and maths are important because you need to be able to understand how the world works. But what about the people who lived through that world? And I suppose it's a very, very roundabout way of asking you the question of how you would feel about people that say, oh, we need to kind of remove history from the curriculum and people don't really need to learn it.
Great question. One of my favorite all-time quotes about education comes from Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt, you know, great 20th century philosopher.
Origins of totalitarianism, was that her?
That's right. Yeah, that's her. That's her. Yeah, exactly. And Hannah Arendt said, and I actually got this quote from one of my favorite history teachers when I was in grade 12. Huh. His name was Atul Ball. So, Mr. Ball, if you're out there listening, if you're a When Diplomacy Fails fan, this one came from you, and he would start his class with it, and I've now incorporated it into my classes.
Cool.
But Hannah Arendt said that education is the point in life where we decide if we love the world enough to take responsibility for it.
Ooh.
And that has always really resonated with me, that the point of education is to learn enough about the world and the human experience to decide whether or not you're going to step up and be one of the people who will guide the world into the next era.
Mm.
And for me, learning to love the world is part of that is you have to know the world's story.
Yeah.
And a way that you learn the world's story is through courses like history. It's through courses like geography. It's through courses like English or whatever language you're speaking, literature, any type of literature studies. It's it's through courses like philosophy. These courses tell you the story of humanity. And it's through those courses that you get to decide whether or not you love the world enough to take responsibility for it. Obviously, subjects like, you know, math, science, what else would be sort of in that vein? You get the idea. Those subjects are extremely important because they give us the tools that we may need to make the world a better place. But they don't teach us or they don't give us the tools to be able to love the world.
No.
And so that's why I think it's so important. That's why I think it needs to be part of the curriculum, because it's opening up the learner to the idea of what they're working for.
Yeah.
Right?
Good, good. Okay. Very, very comprehensive answer. And I just like to add to that. Yeah. I just like to add to that. It's kind of when you talk about like responsibility for the world and everything, I think I might be interpreting this wrong, but when I think of Hannah Arendt and I think of her book on the origins of totalitarianism, I think I read it about 5 or 6 years ago, but it was very kind of haunting and harrowing in places. And I think her kind of experience from saying people need to kind of take responsibility and kind of stand up for, I mean, what's right, I suppose.
For justice.
Yeah, and having surrounded herself in all those horrible eras of human history with the rise of totalitarianism in its various forms, I mean, who better to advise us? It just strikes me as very kind of fitting that someone who was so deep in that kind of stuff would really say to us, look, there's a danger here if we're not aware of where we came from and what we've learned, that I know I was just going to say there that we might repeat our mistakes, but maybe we might do them again, but in a different way. How about that?
I know. No, don't get me wrong. I do believe, I know I just came down hard on that one side of it, but I actually do believe that, you know, especially when it comes to recent history, and I count the last 100 years as recent history, that, you know, especially in terms of, you know, government and ways in which.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Government can go sour, to put it mildly, I guess. I think our history can really at least remind us of how bad things can get. If we're not vigilant and careful and thoughtful and willing to step up and put ourselves on the line when the times call for it.
Yeah.
I don't know, that sounded more harrowing than I meant it to be, but you know.
Yeah. No, that's all good. But I wanna take a different step now before we start kind of going to war or something in the name of history. How about this kind of yet more straightforward question? Where did the idea for your show come from?
Okay, so it actually came from one of my history classes. I was teaching, I forget which course. I think it was the grade 10 20th century history course. You know, you don't have time sometimes to get into really complicated things like the Russian Revolution, say.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of like, we kind of needed to breeze through it. So I was sort of giving the kids kind of a quick little crash course in 1917. But I thought, okay, you know what? I'll give them a break and I'll tell them the crazy story of Rasputin and Rasputin's assassination.
Yeah.
So, you know, I love telling stories. And so I get going really explaining, you know, all the crazy things that are said to have happened around Rasputin's assassination. And I'm sort of acting it out for them. And then one of my students puts up his hand and he's like, isn't that just a myth? And he kind of stopped me in my tracks. And I was like, oh, well, you know what? That's the story that I know.
Yeah.
But you know what? I'm not sure. And maybe it's wrong that I'm, you know, spouting it as real history in this classroom. And I hadn't really done all the homework I could have on that. So I was like, you know what? Great question. So that night I went home and I did some research. And turns out we were both kind of right. The story that I was telling was sort of the accepted story of Rasputin's death. But there were lots of reasons to believe that, you know, it may have been made up by one of the assassins, or it may have been exaggerated. And then there were lots of little details that got added to it after the fact that had sort of dressed it up and made it more mythological. And so I was like, you know what, this is a good lesson. So I sort of took the materials that I was using and sort of brought them back to the class. And we did a whole exercise on how do you pick fact from fiction in the historical record, especially when you have such a fantastic story like the assassination of Rasputin. And so it was a real learning moment. I was like, you know what? I was talking to my wife about it after, and I was like, that was so great. That was one of the best history classes I think I've taught this year. And I'm like, this could be a great podcast. This is interesting. Like, for the hook to be the crazy story, right? The wild thing that happened. And then for the sort of follow-up to be historical detective work, I don't think I know anyone else out there that's really doing the history podcast genre like that. So yeah, I'm going to try it. And so I set about writing a bunch of episodes, and I basically wrote episodes for about half a year before I started recording and then releasing them. And now two years ago, I released my first episode, and here we are today.
Here you are today at the pinnacle of your fame, one could say.
Yes, at the pinnacle. Yes, yeah, the downhill run hasn't started quite yet, but
very good, very good. I always love hearing where people got the idea for their shows, because when I started in May 2012, there was, I mean, you could count on two hands, really, the number of history podcasts, and there was kind of these looming giants in the background. Funnily enough, I didn't actually know about Dan Carlin until I was about a year in. I don't know how he just kind of was under my radar. I don't really know how I missed him out, but my big thing was the history of Rome, and then it was the history of England then, and then it just kind of exploded from there, but yeah, I mean, it's great that there's such a wealth of history podcasts now. I was talking to, I don't know if you know him, but he's a history podcast kind of blogger. Back in the day, he used to review podcasts all the time, and He's still doing it. He's doing this new series now called Anne is a Grumpy Man. His name he's a Dutch guy. His name is Anne, or Anna is the best way to pronounce his name. But he does a history podcasts blog, and I really found it interesting. I was able to kind of have an interview with him, and he was asking me about how I got into it and all that kind of thing. But he was saying how much history podcasting has changed over the last even 5 or 6 years. How the technology has really helped people, because like we take it for granted now. I mean, I don't know what your whole process is, but I know you like to add in music and that kind of thing, which is great.
Yeah.
And I try to do my own take on that too. But I mean, back in the day, adding even like making your podcast into an MP3 file was like a struggle in of itself, and like hosting, just forget about it. Like it was very, very tough. So we're very fortunate now. I think I just got in at just the right time when technology was starting to get better, but that it wasn't so kind of complicated anymore. I mean, it still took me a while to get to grips with it, and sometimes it still does. But yeah, it was just really nice to know that now we're at this stage where if you have an idea or you have a show that you want to pursue, you're not held back by technology.
No, it is a deeply democratic platform. all comers can throw their hat in the ring. I think now, you know, to set yourself apart, you've just got to have an interesting angle, or you need to be a particularly good storyteller. You need to be able to sort of offer a perspective that, you know, people aren't getting otherwise. And also, you know, people like different things in their history podcasts. Like, I like the one voice telling me a story. That's what my show is like. There's lots of shows that sort of do the, like, we're just two or three buddies hanging out and we're just going to kind of riff on this stuff for a little bit. Mm. And a lot of people really love that. A lot of people like that sort of conversational style that, that a lot of shows have. Those aren't my favorite though, to be honest. And I'm not trying to, shoot down anyone out there that's doing that. I mean, there might be some people out there that are like, that's like my show. Yeah. Oh man, Smash Major just totally, you know, took a dump on our show. What a jerk. But I think, I mean, if there are people out there listening who are like, you know what, I want to start a history podcast. The technology is there to make a good sounding, polished feeling product for relatively cheap. The trick is finding an interesting angle, an interesting topic, and an interesting way in. And that's how also you'll start sort of building a fan base. You know, what people that like you, Zach, I think, you know, you have kind of gotten a reputation for being an excellent researcher. You know, you go really deep and fastidious in your collection of sources. Without a doubt, without a doubt. And I think that's something that people that are into history podcasts, they gravitate to you because of that. Cause they're like, you know, this guy really does his homework. And you also give a very balanced appraisal of your topics. And I think after a while, people just get to like you as a presenter, you know, and I think people that kind of gravitate to me, I try to do good research. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to lead people astray and give them sort of crappy historical research. I do a lot of research for these shows, but I think, people that are kind of gravitate to my show like something that's a little more, I guess where storytelling is sort of, is a bit more forward in the style. So, and the people that don't like my show don't like it because they don't like me. Right, like,
really?
And
are they not? Oh, you're so likable, though. I'm not just saying well, that's what you I mean. Say. Like, I like what? Like, do they not like your? Do they not like your hair? Or like, what?
Yeah,
I don't really get that.
The thing is, like, I mean, I throw in lots of, like, I throw in jokes and I throw in the music, and I've got like a sometimes conversational style that I use when I'm talking about certain things, and I like to make it really clear when I'm sharing my opinion, but I also share my opinion like all the time on the show. And for some people that really puts them off. They're like, This guy's not as funny as he thinks he is. I don't need your dumb opinions when it comes to my history. And just give me the goods. Give me the facts.
Oh, wow.
And I know. I mean, I think the people that stick with me, they like my style, and they don't mind my jokes. You know, they enjoy the what I'm doing there.
Sure.
But there is a part of the podcast, especially the history podcast audience, that likes their history like straight up, you know, black coffee, no milk. You know.
Oh yeah.
And that's not me. That's not me. There's other places you can go to get that.
Yeah, there is. The back of some dusty library or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Honestly, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that because, like, when I started out and I used to take everything to heart, it was, I mean, it's not so bad now. I'm thankfully in the position where I don't get too much criticism, and a lot of the time I can just let it wash over me with some exceptions. But there was a few times, when people were like just unnecessarily mean or something. And I'm kind of like, and a few times when people are like, stop making jokes and stop trying to be sarcastic and stop giving your opinion. Yeah. You're kind of like, do you want to just literally, I'll just read from a book. How about that? I read from a book and I don't tell you anything about how I'm thinking or anything. And
yeah. I know, right? Like, I mean, there's sometimes when I just kind of go like, well, welcome to the internet, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this is, you know, this is how it works. And there's another time when people are, it's funny because, like, you know, for every, you know, 9 really, really nice, wonderful things that people will send, and, like, you know, I'm always amazed at how gracious and how sweet listeners are. I'm always blown away by that. I don't want to make it sound like I'm just getting these like reams of hate mail, because that's not true.
I'll stop sending that.
yeah, thanks, Zach. Stinker. No, the thing is that I think if you're someone that's just putting yourself out there and you're making a show that's, you know, these shows are our babies, you know, you care so much about them that, you know, if you look at your iTunes review page and it's like, you know, full of 5-star reviews. And then there's that one guy who's like, this guy sucks.
Yeah.
He's not funny. Yeah. Oh, I hate your music. I hate your music. Oh, stop. Like, it's funny because, again, that's like one out of like literally dozens.
Yeah.
But somehow it sticks with you.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I would like to say that I'm like, oh, water off a duck's back, man. Like, I don't care. Yeah. All good. But because these things are our babies and because these are things that we care about, sometimes they stick with you a little bit.
Mm.
But all that said, the vast majority of the feedback that I get, and I'm sure the feedback you get, is so lovely, is so warm. It's people sharing their own sort of local history stories with me.
Yeah.
It's people telling me, you know, about their lives and, like, you know, how the podcast has fit into their life and, you know, potentially how it's sort of brought them through, you know, difficult times. People who have serious illnesses have reached out to me and sort of talked to me about, like, you know, being bedridden and just listening to history podcasts and that sort of helping them, you know, get through that incredibly difficult time in their life. And, you know, that stuff is so moving.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it ultimately is the stuff that you really take away with you. And
you do.
And that's the stuff that matters, you know?
Mm. At the end of the day, I mean, like, it's amazing, isn't it, to think that we're like, we're just got, I mean, we were talking over Facebook the other day, the two of us, and I was telling you that story about how that guy said that he was listening to your podcast just kind of out of the blue. But it's amazing. Yeah. We're just guys speaking into microphones. And yet, thanks to the internet, one great thing about the internet, like, he can, this guy, Matthew, can, like, hear your podcast in Ireland when you're in deepest, darkest Canada. And he can just he can just listen in. And, you know, it's great. It's really, really good. I feel so privileged, I think, privileged and honored and just so thankful that we're able to be part of something like this, especially when, I mean, unfortunately, no kind of big time academic has really stepped in and said, hey, look, podcasting is the way to go. History podcasts are the best. You should listen to these history podcasts. I mean, I am noticing a slow, gradual uptick in academics joining the kind of bandwagon, so to speak.
But yeah, at the same time, I think there can be no denying history podcasting is expanding and it's reaching more and more people. And I think for us to be at the forefront of that, it's just, it's amazing to see. And at the end of the day, like When Diplomacy Fails' motto, if you like, is where history thrives. And it's just great to see history literally thriving because of people like us who are saying, no, you know, the history curriculum is not sufficient and the History Channel is the drizzling, the drizzles. So,
Man, don't get me started.
Oh, I know. So here are people like us, like standing in, and we are, to go back to your favorite quote, we are showing responsibility and we are showing that we do in fact love the world and we want people to hear these stories because they're important. And I think that's great.
Yeah. And not only are they important, they're fun.
Yes, they are fun. Yeah. People, I mean, my wife even looks at me sideways when she's like, what are you going to do today or something? And I'm kind of like, oh, do you know what? I think I'm just going to relax with this good book. And she kind of is like, what is the matter with you? Or like she even sees me sitting here surrounded. You mentioned sources earlier. If you could see through my eyes right now, I mean, at my desk, I have three individual stacks of books on three individual subjects I'm going to be doing, and I think my computer is sagging with the amount of articles I have. That, yeah, it's mad.
No, man,
but
I doff my cap to you because you know that, and I, as I said before, you know your research is exceptional, and also you do things like you'll take on like really obscure topics that are obscure, I think, to a lot of English speakers, like the Swedish. The years of Swedish expansion.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I mean, and I love that. I love that because that's, you know, again, for the history completist out there, it's like, oh man, like, yeah, I did know that Sweden at one point had this run of sort of dominating Northern Europe, but I don't really know the story. And thankfully, Zach Twombly's on the scene.
Yeah, my Swedish listeners really appreciate it. My Danish ones, maybe not so much, but there you go.
Ah, fair enough.
Yeah. No, there you know. It's all great. It's amazing, again, to think that my stuff is reaching people in Scandinavia, people who don't even have English as a second language. I remember the thing that stands out to me the most, it was, and I think I was only a month or two into podcasting at this stage, but this doctor in Brazil sent me an email, and it was actually in my spam folder for a while, and I didn't read, because you know you get an email from a Brazilian doctor, you're like, yeah, right, of course I need to give you my... But then I read it, and then I was like, oh, okay, it's actually legitimate. He was saying that he's learning, using my history podcast to teach him English, which if you knew about my... Like, this was like 2012, man. I mean, and if you knew my use of language back then, you would be like, well, maybe you shouldn't be using me to teach you English kind of thing.
I really hope that this Brazilian doctor has an Irish accent by the end of it. There'd be nothing more happy or make me more happy than that. That's just, that's beautiful. But that's so cool. I love that.
I was just worried that, like, instead of just using normal language, he'd start being like, thanks to people. just think that was the right way to say thank you. I'd just be worried about that. But
Twombly-ism.
Yeah. Twombly is a weird surname. Let's just say, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was tempted to ask you, I mean, is there any... I mean, this is throwing you way in the deep end, but have you thought of like more kind of specific topics? I mean, you're on Patreon, you've got a good horde of patrons there. I mean, has anyone really asked you to look into maybe like their family's myths or their family's history or anything like that?
No one's ever asked me that. So I just did a thing with my Patreon subscribers where when we hit our first Patreon goal, I let them suggest topics to me, and then we voted on what topics we wanted.
Sure.
So people suggested topics, and then I was sort of the arbiter of the election. So I got to pick of those suggestions. I picked like the top, my top five.
Yeah.
And then I let people then vote on those top five topics. And the people had chosen Vlad the Impaler as our next sort of Patreon topic. So actually, when I'm done with you today, I'm just going to be putting the finishing touches on my Vlad the Impaler episode, and then that's going to be a special extra for my Patreon subscribers. But I do have a bunch of topics in the bank. I've kind of been building them up for my next season. So I just sort of ended my second season of Our Fake History The third season begins on September 12th. So some topics that I as I said before, I want to start looking at the Robin Hood legends. I do want to do some topics about Africa. So I've been researching the Zulus, Shaka Zulu.
Oh, yes. Very good.
Yeah, yeah. And then also a king from what's now Mali named Manu Massa or Massa Manu. I've got to double check that. Anyway, he was sort of the gold king of Africa. And there's all these stories about him making this pilgrimage to Mecca and along the way just spreading around so much gold that like he basically disrupted the local economies with the amount of the amount of gold he was pumping in. That's some stuff I've been looking at. I want to look at Helena Blavatsky. Ever heard of Blavatsky?
No. Russian? Polish?
Yeah, she is Russian, but so that episode's going to be called Who Was the Mother of the Occult?
Okay.
And she was this 19th century mystic, I'll say, who invented her own religion. So her religion was called Theosophy, and she also invented this her own sort of pseudo history to sort of go along with her sort of spiritual beliefs. Now, some of this stuff was terribly, terribly racist and got picked up by the Nazis because there's all this stuff in it about there being sort of this master race. She also sort of spoke about Atlantis. So she was incorporating all of this stuff from Hinduism and Buddhism and, Eastern spirituality. So it's weird. So she had this whole idea that there was this master race that was on Atlantis that sort of that basically invented this sort of true religion. And then after Atlantis sank into the sea, all of these people ended up in Tibet. And from there, Tibet became the sort of center of world religion. From there, they sort of spread out. So it's bananas. It's completely made up. It's
it's a whole bowl of fruit. Yeah.
Oh yeah, man. But it's really fascinating, and she's sort of an interesting figure in her own right. But again, you got to be careful with stuff like that because I don't want people coming away from that being like you're celebrating, you know, the mother of white supremacy. And it's like no, thank you. That's so not me. I don't know how much more you could I could emphasize.
That's that, just you know, what a white supremacist would say.
I know, right? No, I mean I find that stuff so repellent. I can't even tell you.
I know.
But mind you, I am fascinated by these sort of odd characters, and especially an odd character that took it upon themselves to create an alternate history for planet Earth.
Yeah.
So there you go. There's some stuff.
Well, you mentioned being careful there. Is there any myths that you would just studiously avoid for fear of maybe insulting or offending?
People ask all the time for Hitler stuff. People want to know this, and there's a lot of mythology or just legends around Adolf Hitler. I am so afraid of taking that on, because I don't want people to misunderstand me, because by sort of taking on the myths of Adolf Hitler, you get dangerously close to this world of people that will say that the Holocaust was a myth, right? I do not want to get anywhere near that world, you know? And so I almost just want to leave that topic be, just because it's like, no, you know what? Like there is this whole world out there that says that huge events that took place during the Second World War and in the 1930s and the 1940s in Europe didn't happen, that, you know, 6 million people weren't killed in the Holocaust. And that's, you know, that belief is so disgusting.
Yes.
But those people present themselves similarly to how I present myself, which kind of scares me, right? Where these people go like, oh, no, we're just doing like the real historical research. We're separating fact from fiction, and actually this whole thing we think of that as the Holocaust was actually something that was invented by the media at a time to besmirch Germany's reputation.
Yeah.
This is completely ridiculous and completely untrue, and you know flies in the face of, you know, how we perceive reality. I mean, I don't know how you can believe that while there are still, you know, well, there are Holocaust survivors with tattoos on their arms, you know?
Like,
I think I've kind of made it clear where I come down, where I come down on that stuff. But I mean, hey, now it's out there. You're going to put this out and people are going to know, like, you know, Sebastian is not into the Holocaust denier scene. That's okay. That can be out there, that I'm very much opposed to that kind of crap. But by doing a Hitler myth show, you're getting dangerously close to that, because there are things about him that got put out there that weren't true. Like, there's lots of stuff about his sexuality that got kind of brought up. There's also all the stories about him potentially escaping and, like, heading to South America that might be interesting to sort of explore. But I almost don't want to do it, because as soon as you open up the door for, like, well, there's these lies about Hitler, then you get all these other people being like, damn right, there's lies about Hitler. There's all sorts. And so I just, it scares me. It scares me. So there you go. That's one that I'm just, like, so afraid to touch, you know, lest my intention be misunderstood as sort of justifying something truly disgusting and horrible.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw on your Twitter there, someone literally just asked you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were like, I need to build up my courage. So that's funny. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought about actually doing a show on Stalin, and I figure if I can do a Stalin show, then maybe I'll have the courage to take on Hitler one of these days. But, you know, Stalin is another one of these figures that, depending on where you're learning your history and who you're learning your history from, has a very different historical reputation. And, you know, he's one of those people that has gone down as one of the great monsters of the 20th century, for some very good reasons. But then there's still this whole, countercurrent out there that's like, well, he wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. God. And I don't know if you saw, and again, I know we are deep in the weeds here, man, but Oliver Stone just put out his history documentary. This is a series of history documentaries on Netflix called, it was like The Untold History of the United States. I don't know if you saw that. It's really interesting, and I do think people should watch it, but it comes with Oliver Stone's personal biases baked deep into it. And so he's someone that, you know, he's left of center, quite left of center, and he's basically kind of going like, look, there's people that we hold up as heroes that perhaps were not heroes. Like, he really gives Harry S. Truman a really hard time and basically takes him to task for dropping the atomic bombs and having a history of racism and all this other stuff. And he also takes on a number of sort of key sort of political figures in America's history and really takes them to task, many of which, and a lot of times it's like, yeah, man, that's an important point to make. The one thing that kind of drove me nuts about his documentary series was how he treated Stalin. He really lets him off the hook, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm all for, you know, like, let's be super critical about our past, and let's dig into the traditional narrative and perhaps expose some people that we've sort of held up as heroes and be real about, you know, perhaps how complicated or how unsavory they could sometimes be. But to do that and then be like, oh, Stalin wasn't such a bad guy is... To me, is really, really letting your biases blind you in a lot of ways. So, and that's not to say that I don't have my own biases, because I certainly do. but I think you know, it's just important to recognize your biases.
Of course,
and they're going to be there. They're going to be in the mix, but just sort of not letting them, like, you know, take you down like a weird path like that. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Alrighty.
Ah, what'd you think of that? Did you enjoy it? I enjoyed it. I had a great time. In fact, I will go as far as saying this is probably the most fun I've had doing a collaboration episode. I mean, it's definitely up there in the top five, that's for sure. I really did. I learned a lot about Sebastian Major. I have a newfound respect for him, and it didn't even feel like I was talking to a podcaster. It felt like I was talking to an old friend, or a new friend, because he's not that old. I don't know how old he is. I'm sure he's very young. Anyway, this is, just to remind you guys, this is just the first part of two, and the second part will be looking at the Last Siege of Vienna, which, yeah, by the way, is the main reason I got him on in the first place, so if you can wait until next Wednesday, then make sure you do, and make sure you join us for the second part then. But if you cannot wait, then you should know that patrons from $2 and up will get the two pieces of the collaboration episode straight away. So make sure to visit patreon.com/whendiplomacyfails if you are interested. Alrighty guys, that is the collaboration episode for this week. See you next week, or see you in a few seconds, depending on your patience levels. You guys are great. My name is Zach, and you've been listening to When Diplomacy Fails, a collaboration with Sebastian Major. Thanks, and I'll be seeing you all soon.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.